Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, broadcasting from Cedar City today. That's the site of the Utah Rural Summit. They're celebrating their 25th anniversary, and we're glad to be here in the Hunter Conference Center on the campus of Southern Utah University. Panelists at this conference will discuss economic opportunities, demographic change, leadership, natural resources, agriculture in rural Utah, and various breakout sessions. My guests today will include Jack Schultz, founder and CEO of AgriCell Incorporated, and author of Boomtown USA, the 7.5 Keys to Big Success in Small Towns. I'll also be talking with USDA Rural Development State Director for California, Glenda Humiston, who has developed innovative investment models for rural areas. That'll be coming up. First, we are pleased to welcome in our Southern Utah correspondent, Chris Holmes, a voice that'll be familiar to you. Welcome to the program, Chris.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Tom.
And I'm glad to meet you in person.
Yeah. The face never matches the voice in
right.
radio.
Chris Holmes is based in Cedar City. So you're going to be covering this summit. Who are some of the people you're interested in talking to today?
Oh, I think Jack Schultz's presentation is going to be exciting. It'll be taking place here in just a few minutes. Just the subtitle of his book piques the interest, The 7.5 Keys
exactly.
to Success.
We'll be hearing about that shortly on this program. So who else are you interested in talking to?
Well, it's always interesting. I'm interested in talking to the attendees from throughout Utah and talking to them about what their issues are. And you find that in many cases they're common. Friend Weller, who's here with us, spoke to me a moment ago. And he indicated that he was just about ready to move to Cedar City, except that he didn't have a job here. Now, that's the very issue that plagues most rural areas. They're great places to live if you can have a job.
Mm-hmm. That's the whole problem. So we'll be hearing about that on the program today and throughout this summit.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder what you're covering these days. Of course, we hear your reports on Utah Public Radio. We just mm-hmm. had a marijuana bust. I think this is the second of a few. We had the wildfires. What else are you covering here?
It has been a summer of wildfires, not only here in southern Utah, but also in the northern end of the state. And that was very intense, especially in May and June. In July, the monsoon moisture moved in, and that was both friend and foe. It started a few fires, but it also dampened things, and we've had a pattern here in Cedar City over the past month or so where it's been actually quite wet, and so that's improved the situation in terms of wildfires. But in June, it was the place was ablaze, mm-hmm. and so there was a lot of news about that. The recent pot bust that took place here in Iron County was just to the west of us, about 30 miles, as is characteristic of these things. It's a remote area, and it's a place where not many people go. That's by design, of course. And it was actually a citizen who was moving through the area that noticed something that just didn't seem right, that alerted authorities to the situation, and then I think it was 2 or 3 days later, a similar operation was uncovered in Juab County.
As we were mentioning this, I know law enforcement officials are always careful to tell people to be very careful. You come across this,
mm-hmm.
you know, back away, go, and
yeah.
alert law enforcement. Don't get into trouble here.
Yeah.
Prairie dogs, apparently.
That's always an issue here in Iron County. Of course, the prairie dog is a protected species, and if you've got prairie dogs on your private property, there are great limitations in terms of what you can do with that property because of that protected status. And it's really become an issue. For 40 years now, Iron County specifically and Southern Utah generally has been dealing with this issue. And people have really become exasperated. There is a hearing next week in Salt Lake City featuring the Iron County commissioners and other local authorities who will be testifying there. And it's going to be interesting to cover that session as well. I think that was organized by Senator Hatch.
Well, we always look forward to your reports, Chris. Thanks so much. It's good to have you on the air here and to be in your hometown.
It's always my pleasure, and it's a pleasure to have you here.
Well, we go next to Jack Schultz, a nationally recognized writer, founder of AgriCell, and author of Boomtown USA, The 7.5 Keys to Big Success in Small Towns. He's giving a presentation at the Utah Rural Summit. My conversation with Jack Schultz next. Let's start with your hometown, Effingham, Illinois. I guess it was facing some problems that a lot of rural towns face.
In the late 80s, we were looking at 3,000 of our 4,000 manufacturing jobs, and a town of 12,000 people were suddenly at risk. Had a couple of companies that had moved out of town, one that was looking at moving to South Carolina, and a fourth one that was looking at consolidating one of their three plants. And so the whole economy died. And a small group of us got together and decided that we had to take things into our own hands, that we could no longer be held hostage by some corporate board, wherever they were located.
And you were successful.
It took a while. It took 5 years. It's a long-term proposition, but once we got the first project in, they started to fall like dominoes. And a couple of years ago, Site Selection magazine chose us as the sixth best town in America with creating jobs and opportunities.
How big a town is Effingham?
It's 12,000 in a county of 34,000. Okay. So very rural. We're about 200 miles south of Chicago, so a very rural community out down in southern Illinois.
And I imagine you were facing, still do face, some of the problems that all rural towns
everybody
face.
Everybody does. And but as a result of that experience, started to go out, and our local utility saw what we were doing and said, there's not somebody doing what you're doing in rural America. And we expanded and have now done projects in about 15 states around the country.
So your founder, CEO of AgriCell, tell us about that.
AgriCell I set up 25 years ago, started out in agriculture investments, and is why the name is AgriCell. But in the early 90s, got involved in industrial development and have done about 100 manufacturing projects around the country in rural communities, so trying to bring high-paying manufacturing jobs to rural towns around the country.
And you write in your introduction that you were curious. Are there characteristics, are there principles, are there methods which are transportable, which can be used by any rural town? And the obvious answer is yes.
That's what we that was our thesis. We started out, and it was a result of traveling around the country and doing projects and seeing one community that was doing great things and then a community right next to it that was just dead in the water. And started to do the research, thought it would be about a six-month project to research and write. It turned into about a three-year project. It was much longer than we thought, but the book caught fire, and I've now had the opportunity to do talks and tours in over 400 towns in 44 states around the country. So it's been a wonderful experience.
I imagine. And you've seen some success stories, probably some failures as well. I wonder if we could go through your 7.5 keys to big success in small towns. The first one is about attitude, isn't it?
Can-do. It's can-do. Attitude. Have a can-do attitude. And then there's a reason it's number one, is that we see that as really the key factor as we look at what makes a successful community or one that's not so successful is the attitude of the people and the willingness to work together and to go towards a common goal.
So it really is that simple? I guess it can't be that simple, right?
That's one of the keys.
Right,
Not the only key.
But it starts with that. People have to have a goal.
If you don't have a common goal and a kind of a shared mission, it's very difficult to marshal all of the different forces that might be trying to take you off in different directions. An example is Leavenworth, Washington, which was a small town in very rural Washington that had fallen from 5,000 to 1,000 people and looked like it was headed towards becoming a ghost town when 11 women in the town decided to turn things around and reinvented the town as a Bavarian village, even though there were no Bavarians that lived in the town. And today that town has grown from 1,000 to 2,000 people and has 500 members in their Chamber of Commerce. Encouraged a lot of their young people to move back, new people to move into the community. They've been so successful that they've had 30 families that have moved to the town from Bavaria.
Really?
Right. Because it's such a Bavarian.
Bavaria.
Yeah, actually moved from Bavaria to Leavenworth because of their Bavarian theme. Hmm. And bring in about 1.5 million tourists a year as a result of those efforts. And if it hadn't been for those 11 women, that town would today be probably a ghost town.
Hmm. So what kinds of things are you seeing? You talk in the book about attracting manufacturing jobs. That's going to be much more efficient, basing your taxes off of businesses than personal taxes. There's tourism. There's all sorts of things. What's the range that you've seen?
Well, there's tourism. There's high tech. There's manufacturing. There's service businesses. There's just a whole range of different things that communities can do, and it's really, I think, finding your niche and then capitalizing on that niche and developing clusters of what you're good at and doing it over and over again.
Key number two, shape your vision.
Shape your vision is a key one, and it's really deciding what you want to be and how you differentiate yourself from the 15,800 other small towns in the country. And seeing some great examples of that, of really it's creating a sense of place about your community and making yourself an attractive place of where people might want to move to or where your young people might want to move back to.
And you've written in a follow-up to Boomtown that some of the things which attract these people who can, and that's one of the trends, isn't it, that nowadays more and more people can live where they want.
They can live any place they want. I've been in towns where half of the people, I was in a town in Colorado, and as I introduced myself to the audience, probably half of the audience said they were refugees from California and had moved to Colorado because of the quality of life issues as opposed to being still living in California. And many of them were telecommuting and are commuting back once a month to run their businesses in California.
And this is, you call this, the third wave?
Third wave of migration.
Of
yes.
Migration.
Right.
So people are, not only people, but businesses are nowadays, through many trends, freed up to go where they want to go.
It's much less expensive to operate in rural areas, and because of technology and being able to convert to do business any place in the country, any place in the world. I've got examples of businesses in very rural parts of North Dakota that are literally selling products to dozens of countries around the world, in addition to every single state. So
just because of improvements in communication and transportation.
Yeah,
and
yeah. If you don't have broadband and the ability to operate on the internet as a rural community, it's like not having water or sewer in your in your town. It's a or electricity. It's a basic need for the future.
You're right. Let's see, this chapter 13, the significance of the third wave. We just been talking about that. With about 1 million people each year moving out of the larger cities, cannot be overstated. 1 million people a year.
1 million people a year.
Moving to what you call the agurbs?
To the agurbs. Booming rural communities with a quality of life where people are going to want to live and work and raise a family in the future.
Define agurbs for us.
Agurbs are, it was a term we came up with and trademarked. It's booming communities that have that quality of life about them that are where people are going to want to live in the future. Mm-hmm. So it's population growth and it's business growth and it's creating those type of opportunities.
And this wave, the third wave, as you call it, is being fueled, I take it, also by a generation shift. The younger generations want, they're emphasizing more quality of life.
The millennial generation, which is between the ages of 12 and 30 years of age, which, by the way, is going to be the most entrepreneurial generation in the history of the United States, is more focused upon the quality of life. So I'm a baby boomer. In our when I graduated from college, we would get a job, and if we had to move any place in the world, we would have pack the bags and move. The millennials are not so inclined. They're looking first at quality of life, consider themselves to be more free agents, if you will, and so they're going to choose where they want to live and figure they're good enough that they'll find a job once they get to where they want to live.
And one of the keys, I'm looking at a brochure, an update of Boomtown USA. By the way, we're talking with Jack Schultz, if you just joined us, and we're at the Rural Summit, Utah Rural Summit, 25th Annual Rural Summit in Cedar City, coming to you from Cedar City today. Boomtown USA, the 7.5 keys to big success in small towns. You say the arts are very important.
The arts are becoming increasingly important. Again, it's part of the quality of life, the sense of place. And so, for example, the Shakespeare Festival here that my wife and I went to last night, a wonderful example. And I love Cedar City's town of festivals or city of festivals. They're in addition to the Shakespeare Festival, a number of other festivals that they put on. Those are the type of events, those are the types of arts that will help attract those young people to a community.
You said some 15,000 small towns.
15,800 small towns in the country.
How do we define small town? What's the population?
We defined them as being outside of an MSA. So even though it was a small town but was adjacent to Salt Lake City, we didn't consider that in our database because we didn't want to look at just how urban sprawl might be affecting a small town. So we were looking at communities outside of the MSAs. They had to be less than 52,000 in population. So we looked at towns as small as 50, 100 people and up to 52,000 in size.
So this 15,800 towns, you're each of those towns trying to take advantage of this third wave. So right. In competition, in essence, with each other, and so you have to carve out your own niche.
You have to carve out your own niche, yeah. And not all of the 15,800 small towns are going to succeed. Hmm. There's going to be more that fail than succeed.
So adopt a can-do attitude is key number one. Key number two, shape your vision. Number three, leverage your resources.
That's taking your natural attributes that you have in a community, whether it might be agricultural production or it might be some famous person or it might be mountains or rivers or streams or whatever your natural resources are in a community. It might be your base of people in a community. Of what they can do to create jobs and opportunities.
Here in Utah, you've cited in the book Ephraim in San Pete County, their Scandinavian Festival, which has become established.
Absolutely. Another one that's not in the book but that I'm going to talk about today is Plain City, which most people who think of Plain City probably think of their agricultural production. I've also heard it's got huge mosquitoes and milk and that sort of thing. But actually, Plain City has a very unique distinction in that three of the top 100 trucking companies in the whole United States were born in Plain City. And a fourth that is almost in the top 100 was also from there. So
wow.
You have CR England, Swift, Knight Transportation, and Pride Transportation that all birthed in Plain City. The challenge is that there's not a lot of jobs for those companies, or their headquarters are in Salt Lake City and Phoenix. And so one of the challenges that I have for communities, and we'll give some examples today, of how do you reach out and how do you stay connected with those very successful people that might be from your community, have a deep attachment to their community, of how do you get them back to help create jobs in your community.
You call that the brain bank?
The brain bank, yeah, that a lot of people look at it as a brain drain. I look at it as a brain bank of people that have grown up in the community, have a deep affection for the community, but that have taken their talents to other places. There's great opportunities to have them come back to put in a call center, to put in a manufacturing plant, or to reinvest in the community in some way. And many of them are wanting to move back to the community when they retire.
The key number four to big success in small towns, we're talking with Jack Schultz on his book Boomtown USA, raise up strong leaders. Leadership is important.
Leadership is critical, and it is one that we really see as an advantage of small towns in that it only takes one or two or a handful of people to really make a difference. And unlike a big city where you need a big group of people, is that in a small town, small group of people can make a huge difference of leading the community forward into the future.
You talked about these 11 ladies who turned this town into Bavaria.
Right.
Are there other examples of leadership?
Oh, there's a lot of there's a lot of examples. I have an example just recently in Spring Valley, Mississippi, where a group of four young ladies, all in their 20s and 30s, have taken a dying town and have recreated it as an arts town in the town of Mississippi. And other examples, I'm going to be talking about a community, Paducah, Kentucky, in my talk, which took one of their old dying parts of their town and turned it into an arts mecca also, and sold artists from around the country old buildings, dilapidated buildings, for a dollar, and a local bank agreed to lend 100% to fix those buildings up, and brought in over 100 artists from around the country that were literally starving artists that were attracted by those type of attributes in a community.
It's amazing, as you read these stories, you tell us some of these stories, I guess that can-do attitude is important. If you start out maybe you get somewhere you hadn't even envisioned.
That is very, very much the case, is that if you don't have that can-do attitude, you're probably behind the eight ball for a long, long time.
Yeah. One thing you talk about is revitalizing downtowns. The first thing is get signage to point people to downtown, and then try to get people back to downtown.
When I started the research, I was not so attracted to downtowns. I thought they were all dying. But as I've done more of the research and traveled around the country, I've seen the impact of downtowns, and having a revitalized downtown can be a huge quality of life factor for a community.
The next key number five, encourage an entrepreneurial approach.
This is one that I would move, if I was writing the book today, I would move it to number two. And I really see this as the critical factor going forward, is that we're having a paradigm shift occurring in economic development, and that we're going to spend less time out trying to recruit in new businesses, and instead we're going to grow businesses from the inside. And the real advantage, and a huge advantage that Utah has, is the millennial generation. Which is the ages of 12 to 30 years of age, is going to be the most entrepreneurial generation in the history of the United States, already being compared to the generation of the 1880s that transformed the U.S. from a third world country into a world power. They have got it in their DNA to start new businesses, and what we've got to do is harness that. And the advantage that Utah has is that Utah has the youngest aged group in the country, average of 29 years of age, compared to the average in the country of 37 years. So Utah has a huge advantage in taking advantage of this trend as it moves forward.
One of the things you told me you wanted to talk about is Blanding. Apparently Blanding has a good program.
I'm using lickety-split chocolate. Elaine Bergen had six kids knock on her door a couple of years ago looking for money to go to the movies, and she said, you know, I could give you money today, but I couldn't tomorrow, but let's come back and let's brainstorm on how you might be able to make money to be able to go to the movies whenever you want to. And she's going to be doing a work session with me after my keynote talk to talk about kind of this social entrepreneurism that can happen with youth, and an example here in Blanding.
The next key, maintain local control. That's key number six.
Yeah, the local people are often willing to stick their neck out when a branch manager of a big company is saying, well, it's not something that we can really do. And I've seen example after example of where the locals have done things that have been out of the ordinary, like those 11 women in Leavenworth. That, you know, when they did that study, they had the head of the architecture and design department of University of Washington was there. And his son came up to me after one of my talks and said, my dad thought those ladies were crazy. And but they stuck with it. They put their local resources to work and made that community work as a result.
The seventh key, build your brand.
Build your brand is a critical one of getting the message out. Leavenworth's known in the Northwest United States, but how about Branson, Missouri? I mean, virtually everybody in the country knows of Branson, Missouri, a town that was of 3,000 people that was out in the middle of nowhere, an hour off the interstate on a winding two-lane road that has today transformed themselves into the live music capital of the world, and today have 56 theaters bringing 7 million tourists a year because of that niche that they've developed and branded themselves as such to bring in more and more visitors to their community.
And the book is Boomtown USA, the 7.5 keys to big success in small towns. What's the half key?
The half key really relates to a can-do attitude, and it's whether if you think of your community as a teeter-totter, and you think of yourself up on top of the teeter-totter, is that you remember that it didn't take a lot of pressure from down below, and suddenly you were down in the dirt. And it's the same way with a community, is that as you as a community, are you taking those risks, if you will, or those chances to help take your community to that higher level, or are you going to be listening to those curmudgeons in the town? Every town's got them that are saying, we could never do something like that. That's way too risky for this town to try to do. And if you're going to listen to those people, I can guarantee you that you're not going to find those opportunities to bring your kids and your grandkids back to your community.
One of the points in your brochure I found interesting is you suggest creating a community foundation.
We have seen them all over the country, and it's one of the key factors that I see, that with especially with the transfer of wealth that's going to happen in this country, is to capture some of those funds and to use it to help perpetuate communities for generations into the future. I've been in small towns that have as much as $250 million in a community foundation. We set up one in our town 10 years ago, and today it has about $7 million in it. So that will be there for forever to help scholarships with do things that that can help the community in the long term.
A couple of final questions. I'm wondering, you know, this is very inspiring to hear about towns that have used these keys and have been successful. Are there towns maybe that are just too rural or too off the beaten track or too whatever to perhaps use?
I think there's something in it for every community, and it really is not anyone that's so far off the beaten path. There are people that want to go to those type of places, and maybe you can use off the beaten track to promote yourself as a place to come and look at the stars, for example, or to do other types of promotions that would help to create those jobs and opportunities. And also with broadband, we're seeing businesses that are set up all over the country in very small towns that are able to sell all over the country if you have the right idea.
And on the other side of the coin, can you be too successful? Can you expand beyond ruin the character of your town?
Absolutely. And I think that's a challenge with those communities that are growing rapidly is losing that small town feel and why people move to a community. And you see it all the time with urban sprawl that's happening and where people are moving further and further out because they're looking for that quality of life. So you can be too successful. But I'd rather have too much success as being in some of the towns where the average age is up to in the 50s and 60s, and it's a community that is slowly dying and in a death spiral.
Yes, definitely a better problem to have. By the way, just in mentioned passing, in your book, you mentioned Logan as a Golden Eagle. They're doing some good things. Park City, you mentioned the Sundance Film Festival is a good thing as well. Some Utah places that are doing well. Boomtown USA, the 7.5 Keys to Big Success in Small Towns. Jack Schultz, the author, founder and CEO of AgriCell. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom.
And you're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and we are coming to you from the Utah Rural Summit. It's their 25th anniversary. Several speakers, including Jack Schultz, Dr. Robert Lang, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, Dr. Glenda Humiston, California State Director for USDA Rural Development, and in fact, she's my next guest following a break. Craig Bullerjack, Governor Gary Herbert, many talks, and they'll be discussing economic opportunities, demographic change, leadership, natural resources, and agriculture in rural Utah. We're pleased to be on the campus of Southern Utah University for the broadcast today from the Utah Rural Summit. And we're back with Glenda Humiston following this break.
Support for Access Utah is brought to you by Utah State University Extension, improving the quality of life for individuals, families, and communities by extending USU to the people. More information at extension.usu.edu.
On the next Putumayo World Music Hour, we'll dance the tango in its many forms, from the traditional bandoneon of Argentina to the pulsing electronica of the new tango of Finland and Norway. I'm Rosalie Howarth. Join me for Tango Around the World, the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Friday night at 10 o'clock on Utah Public Radio.
Access Utah is brought to you by Utah State University Extension, integrating teaching, research, and public service to respond to critical and emerging issues with research-based information. Utah State University Extension can be followed on Facebook.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and we are in the Hunter Conference Center on the campus of Southern Utah University in Cedar City on the occasion of the Utah Rural Summit. Several speakers are presenting, including my guest in the last half of the program, Jack Schultz with the Boomtown USA. Governor Herbert is here, Senator Hatch, several other presenters, including Robert Lang and Craig Bullerjack will give a presentation tomorrow on day two of the conference. Right now, we bring in Glenda Humiston, who is USDA's Rural Development State Director for California. She has spent many years in the private sector and just recently come into the USDA and taken that position in California. And she's gone on a listening tour of California and developed some innovative solutions to economic development in California. So conversation next with Dr. Humiston. So first of all, tell us about USDA Rural Development. You're state director for California. What does USDA Rural Development do?
We've got about 47 programs that run the gamut of business, economic development, community facilities, rural utilities, and a lot of housing, both single family and multifamily, as well as several specific grant programs.
And I understand you recently went on a listening session all around California, followed that up with town hall meetings in all of the counties. Fairly ambitious. And what questions were you asking?
Well, when we did the original forums in January of 2010, we basically were asking folks, what can be done to help you have jobs, economic development, and sustainable communities, healthy communities? And we got a lot of feedback. In fact, our jobs report that's online at our website is considered to be one of the best overviews of strategies needed for those topics. Then a year later, starting in January through the middle of April 2011, I followed that up with a town hall forum in every single county that I personally attended and made a presentation on, okay, this is what we heard a year before, this is what we've done since then, and we brought together a lot of partners and kicked off a lot of strategies. So what do you think? Are we on the right track? Do you like what we're doing? You got any new ideas? Give us a little feedback here. And I felt that was really important because all too often the senior political officials blow into a town forum. They listen a few minutes, and then they're gone. And you never know what's really getting done with that. And if we're going to get our citizenry engaged in solutions, we've got to keep them engaged all the way through the process.
Before we get to solutions, and I want to there's some interesting innovative ideas that come out of these listening sessions, what are the problems that you're we probably all heard the problems, so maybe we could just tick those off again. You probably heard about those at these forums.
We're not talking rocket science. Yeah. I mean, there's concerns about inefficiencies in government, local, state, federal not always coordinating well, one branch of government not coordinating well, the public sector, the private sector not coordinating well, lack of resources, lack of focus on education, particularly for a lot of middle-skill jobs that are really crucial to industry clusters. Et cetera.
Middle skill jobs. Give us an example.
Well, all the jobs that are kind of in between for the food chain, let's say like a farm worker, and then there's the consumer. Almost everything in between other than management would be middle skill, processing, distribution, handling, truck driving, et cetera.
One of the key questions I understand you were asking and hearing from people about is what's needed to create jobs and economic development. That's crucial, of course.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, one of the big things that really leaped up, well, a couple big things, was a need to focus on regional industry clusters. Really understand what those are, where the opportunities are, and then zero your efforts at those opportunities. Another key thing that popped up was the need to really start building more, along with those regional industry clusters, more of a focus on investing local, buying local, building the value chain. And this is something more and more of our large firms and large corporations are getting engaged with, too, through something called shared value, where they're trying to not only get social benefit, but bottom line return on investment for actions and dollars they invest.
So not just selling the agricultural products, but building out that value chain. Can you give us some examples of what that would look like? What are the businesses or those additional steps in that value chain?
Well, a perfect example that we're putting a lot of focus on in California right now, and this is just one of many, but in the livestock meat value chain, we've got a lot of demand for grass-fed beef, organic lamb, free-range turkeys, just whatever you want to call that kind of meat, or even just local sourced meat, regardless of whether it has any other certification. Huge demand. The people that are trying to market it, like restaurants and Whole Foods, et cetera, will tell you they can't get enough supply. They can't even come close to enough supply. And at the same time, we've got ranchers all over the state that would love to supply that product. But there's no, the in-between infrastructure is missing. Largely what we're missing is animal harvesting facilities, which used to be known as slaughterhouses, but we don't prefer to call them that anymore. Animal harvesting facilities, cut and wrap.
We are short people who actually know how to handle meat, distribution, processing, et cetera. So we're really focused on trying to get that kind of infrastructure in place, working with our community colleges on the needs for training, with the local business sector on how to perhaps form a cooperative or some other business entity that could take on that facility and cold storage related facilities.
What do you think the potential is here? You can expand these agriculture and other business by a factor of what, do you think?
Oh, it's actually huge. We had a study last summer from our California Centers for Excellence that showed if California would pursue a strategy of those jobs in that in between the farm and the fork, we could produce over 181,000 jobs within the next 5 years, averaging almost $24 an hour. These are head of household jobs. They're predominantly what would be labeled light industry.
Tell me a little bit more about these regional clusters. Give me an example.
Well, I've mentioned food already. Mm-hmm. We've got several of those springing up around the state. Another one that we're really working closely with is biomass, both for biomass directly into products like electricity, compost, pellets, et cetera, but also biofuels. Huge, huge opportunity there. In fact, we last year had a jet at one of our local Navy bases flying on biofuels made from beef and chicken tallow. Just to give you one example, algae, et cetera. Another huge thing that's growing fast related to that is bio-based products. In fact, Secretary Vilsack unveiled our USDA bio-based certification program about 3 months ago. And if you go on that website, you can already find companies in literally every state that are producing bio-based products right now. So we're working very closely with regional industry clusters that have the biomass to then facilitate how do they get that raw product to facilities, make sure the facilities are there, and then get it to consumers. At the same time, we're collaborating with research because there's a lot of potential for new products related to that as well.
Have we seen some of the new products coming out? Do we have examples of what new products
well,
might look like?
Jet fuel out of beef tallow is a fairly new product, actually.
That's surprising.
As of less than a year ago. Pharmaceuticals are being looked at out of biomass. New uses of them in plastics and fibers. I mean, there's actually quite a bit happening with biomass. People, when you say biomass, people tend to think of ethanol. And, you know, really, that's not where the exciting future is. It's in all these other products related to biomass.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Glenda Humiston, who is USDA Rural Development Director for California. And she's been involved in listening sessions all over California, looking at some innovative solutions to problems in rural America. And she's giving a presentation at the Utah Rural Summit. They're celebrating their 25th anniversary this year. We're here in Cedar City on the campus of Southern Utah University for the Utah Rural Summit. And our thanks to USU Cooperative Extension for their help with this broadcast. I was viewing a presentation of yours. This was the Sierra Innovation Summit. Mm-hmm. I guess they're all looking for innovative ways to solve some of these problems. You're saying that some of the traditional jobs or job sectors are definitely declining and probably not going to come back at the levels that they were before. Farming, forestry, fishing, and some of those other type jobs. But there are increases, or you hope there'll be increases, in secondary and tertiary jobs.
Absolutely.
What are those types of jobs? We've been talking a bit about some of those.
Well, secondary is obviously the middle skill type jobs, truck driving, the people doing distribution, handling, plumbers, electricians, that kind of thing. And then your tertiary jobs would be those engineers, research, management, executives, marketing, et cetera, logistics. And those are where the job growths are. If you saw the slide I was using in that one presentation, the growth in those is huge. It's almost the exact opposite going up as the jobs in the primary occupations are going down. And people know that. I mean, less than 2% of the folks out there right now are directly in the farming, whereas in the 50s it was, what, like 50-60% of the population.
And I guess an increase in the trend that I think a lot of us familiar with rural America have been seeing, an increase in off-farm income. In other words, I had a friend who grew up in high school, said he wanted to go into engineering and make a good living so that he could come back and afford to run a farm, which is, you know, struck a chord with the place I was growing up in rural Utah. But I guess that's an increasing trend.
Yeah, unfortunately it is. It's got several aspects to it, and it's a real personal one for me. I grew up on our family's cattle ranch in southwest Colorado, and my dream was to run that cattle ranch. But about my mid-20s, when I came back from my Peace Corps service, my parents had to sit me down and say, hey, kid, you know, both of us are working off the farm. There's nothing here for you. There's no way for you to make a living here. And we're seeing that increasingly in farms across the nation. In fact, all too often, what you see in succession is grandparent to grandchild. That's actually skipping generations. And more a spouse or even the primary farmer might be working off farm or have – and increasingly with internet and telework they can work on the farm, too. We're seeing more and more of that. And increasingly, people are finding very creative ways to do things on the farm with agrotourism and related type activities.
So I think a lot of people want to continue that life, but you have to get creative to continue it, I guess.
Yeah, it's a life that people get very passionate about. I mean, if you have farming in your heart, you're very passionate about it. And thank goodness, because all of us need to eat three times a day. We need folks out there farming. Mm-hmm. One of the huge problems we're facing in this nation right now is an aging farmer human resource problem, because we are really desperately looking to see where we can bring that next generation of farmers on. In fact, Secretary Vilsack speaks about this a lot. One of the big outreach efforts we have going on right now at USDA is with returning veterans, trying to convince them to give agriculture a look. And we've had some great success with that in California. We're working very closely with veterans hospitals and VA administration and local efforts to find opportunities for returning vets, many of whom are facing severe unemployment, outlooks.
Are these veterans who've had a background in farming or family in farming, or you just tell them, hey, this might be a good occupation for you?
You know, with less than 2% of the population farming, there's not a lot of folks that do have that background in farming, and we need more farmers. And the reality is, with a lot of the new farming techniques that are coming on, particularly in urban and high-density agriculture, it's almost a whole new skill set anyway. One of the things, particularly for some of the disabled veterans, that's very exciting is these vertical wall type agriculture systems where you literally can work. You could be a farmer from a wheelchair. And the amount of food that is produced off these systems is phenomenal. It is a head of household type job. You can make a good living income being a farmer with some of these systems. We have people buying up warehouses in Los Angeles, putting in these indoor growing operations, usually for very high specialty type crops. But still, there's a demand for high specialty crops.
Vertical wall, you just grow your crops up?
Is that you've got a vertical wall. And often they're a very closed loop system in that there'll be a trough of water underneath that also has fish in it. So the water from that's going up and watering the plants, coming back down and recycling, and you're producing fish, you're producing the crops, you're recycling the water. It's extremely high tech. And for a lot of these young men, particularly young men and women coming out of the military that have had that kind of technical training to use today's military systems, it's a real good fit.
Another statistic jumped out at me. If I've got this right on your slide, no more than 2% nationally, I guess, of jobs or economic development comes from businesses relocating. You hear a lot about that. Towns get into bidding wars for businesses. You have that as a goal, and I guess that is a worthy goal, but no more than 2% nationally comes from that. And it was 90% or something comes from expansion of existing businesses or entrepreneurship.
I'm not sure if that statistic is valid nationally. That's from our California California Public Policy Institute, so it's for California. But it probably is very similar nationally, would be my guess, given the research we've done. Yeah, less than 2% comes from recruitment. And when you actually look at the amount of money spent on recruitment by local governments and economic development corporations, one of the messages I and many others out there right now are trying to give local government, regional government, economic development corporations is just stop it. Stop wasting that money bribing some corporation to bring you a couple hundred jobs. I think it's 50-some percent of job growth comes from existing businesses growing and expanding. And the rest, almost 50%, comes from entrepreneurs. And we have tied together in California and other regions. We're not doing this from scratch. We're looking all over the nation and even the world for where there's great examples we can learn from, not reinventing the wheel. But tying together this comprehensive program of not just buy local, but support your local businesses, tie together your regional industry clusters, see where the jobs are in those value chains, do a leakage analysis to see what you might be able to do locally that's currently not done locally. And tied all that together that's just kicking off in California is an invest local strategy. We're going to be pushing that hard the next several months when we release our report in a couple weeks on access to capital. And a key part of Invest Local is bring our money back home local for that investment.
That's a big problem, isn't it?
It's a huge
capital
problem.
Squeeze and with the economic downturn, maybe that's exacerbated the problem.
Well, the problem has been there a long time, at least 10 to 40 years. You know, it's been an evolving problem. But just to give you one example, not talking about stocks or bonds or any of that kind of stuff, although it holds true for them. If you look at retirement accounts, which is where most average people have any capital they have other than, you know, perhaps equity in their home, assuming they have some equity in their home nowadays, all of that money, 98, 99% of that money, IRAs, 401ks, is invested in Wall Street securities. It's being sucked out of our local communities, and it's not coming back. Other than Silicon Valley, San Francisco, Fortune 500 firms, no local businesses, no regional industry clusters are getting that kind of investment money back. So we're kicking off a strategy in California to just bring 5% of those retirement accounts home to invest locally, which in California would be about $43 billion we would have to invest in our businesses, our manufacturing firms, our clusters, our infrastructure, our communities. It's what the economy needs to get jump-started.
And the goal would be persuasion? Persuade the holders of capital
to
invest?
No, you know something? In my travels, I have found there's a hunger for this opportunity. People recognize that there's you are going to go to the dry cleaners, the restaurant, the grocery store in your community. And if they're making a profit, which hopefully they are, why shouldn't you be getting a little bit of that while you're helping them? It's a win-win for both the business and you and the community. But the intermediaries, the structures to facilitate that, and the legal ability to do that haven't existed. However, we've spent the last couple of years in California creating some of those structures, and one in particular we're very excited about that we're going to be unveiling here this month.
You also talk about quality of life, and I'm sure this is something you have heard on your listening tour. What are some things that can be done there?
Well, quality of life is a complicated subject. It's a matter of having access to education, access to amenities, infrastructure that's functioning, and a good job. Healthcare, I mean, all of these are factors. And you can't really overlook one for another. All too often people come into a community and it's like, oh, let's make sure we have a theater. Or let's put some trees in the median of town. Those are important. They're good. But really what we need is all the different stakeholder groups in a community sitting down saying, okay, how do we get a quality of life that looks at all those various factors and really start prioritizing our limited investments to get that going?
And I was interested, you talk about social capital and talk about some innovative solutions you know, maybe people wouldn't think about. You got some law students involved in untangling some legal issues, got some business counseling going. These are some things, I guess, that could be replicated.
Absolutely. We got the Graduate School of Management at UC Davis to do a business plan for a biomass facility up in the Northern Sierras, and they did a fantastic job. Those law students did a great job doing reviews for us, answering questions. And again, that content's involved in our report. And just the volunteers. The California Financial Opportunities Roundtable that put that report together with me, were almost 100 people from every segment of the finance world, small business, economic development, local, state, federal government. And we mixed them up so that we could spark new ideas and new thoughts off of that diverse interaction.
As we close, what would be your one piece of advice for people doing rural development?
Collaboration. Build the collaboration, urban and rural partnerships, all the various stakeholders, and get creative. Look at what you can do locally. We need to understand that with the current financial situation, money is not going to be coming from the federal government. And I have to admit, I'm not sure about Utah government, but California, certainly we're not looking for money from the state government either.
Glenda Humiston has been our guest. She's presenting at the 25th anniversary of Utah Rural Summit. Get that out there. And we are at the summit today, broadcasting Access Utah from the campus of Southern Utah University. Glenda Humiston is California State Director for USDA Rural Development. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And our thanks to Glenda Humiston and Jack Schultz and Chris Holmes and to USU Cooperative Extension for their help with this broadcast. That concludes broadcast from Southern Utah University in Cedar City for the 25th anniversary edition of the Utah Rural Summit. Thanks for listening to Access Utah.
Utah State University Extension, a partnership of federal, state, and local governments delivering educational programs at the grassroots level throughout the nation. USU Extension celebrating 100 years of 4-H youth programs in Utah.
We're in the shoulder season down here in Los Cabos. The weather has turned from warm to hot, and the humidity, well, it's cranked up a notch or two. So it's quiet time down here. This is the season when those who call Los Cabos home usually head out of town for a while. Last year, we were about the only folks in the condo complex we were living at the time. Most everybody had left, and even those who would come down for frequent visits stayed away. To top it off, our air conditioner has not been working well lately. There have been a couple of days when, as we were out and about doing household errands, the thermometer in our car pushed up to past 3 digits. You can imagine what it felt like in our house. But we've adapted. We know how and when to try for the ocean breezes that still waft through and know when to push the AC a little harder to maximize its output. There's always a pull for a quick dip, and, well, the rest of it, it's actually quite nice, really. I mean, yeah, we do have to keep an eye on our personal thermostats. That's why we take cold water everywhere we go, whether it's a short jaunt to the grocery store or elsewhere. But otherwise, we rather like it. Sunday night, for example, it was way too hot to cook, so we decided to go into Centro San Jose del Cabo for dinner. Went to a little place we like called Jasmine's. It's at the top of a small hill, just a couple of blocks up from the historic art district. The town was relatively empty, hardly a soul in sight, which meant we had no trouble finding a parking spot across the street from the restaurant. We walked in, and we were the only people in the place. Seated at a table for two, we enjoyed the cool air, the music, and a couple of cold drinks while nibbling on chips and salsa. Now, Jasmine's does this really tasty salsa where they sort of scorch the peppers a bit and get a smoky flavor out of them. It's really good. Just enough hint of heat, plus lots of flavor. Kara had the chicken enchiladas while I went for this thing they call chicken breast molcajete. It's a unique regional dish of chicken cooked in a rich, fiery broth with tomatoes, peppers, Oaxaca cheese, and a bunch of other really tasty spices. It's heaven on your tongue. And we chilled out, just the two of us. We felt sort of spoiled and pampered, having all of the restaurant's attention focused on us, without the normal sounds of babbling diners, and we had a really nice, relaxing meal. It was also good to have alone together time. This is Ed Casilia for Utah Public Radio.
The This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSUFM HD1 91.5 Logan.
Support for programming on the Utah Public Radio Network is made possible in part by our listeners and the Logan City Environmental Department, providing waste disposal services to Cache County residents, including green waste, curbside recycling, and household hazardous waste disposal. More information at loganutah.org.